Hello everyone, it's Dr. D with my response to the discussion forum about covenant and commandments, week four of our 8 weeks together. Again, a couple of reminders. One, I think I went over this in the lectures, but let me be clear. When we talk about Torah with a lower case T, the best translation is not law. That is a New Testament thing. In the Hebrew Bible, Torah was understood as teaching, and the commandments were not seen as laws that we might consider today. They weren't obligations that they had to do in order to earn God's love or forgiveness, but rather a set of practices for how they were to live in covenant with God, neighbor, and self. Another reminder, everyone signed the Just Language Covenant, which required you to be cautious with your language for both the holy and for people, and that using exclusively male pronouns for the deity is not abiding by that covenant. So once again, if you will do your post in a word processor, you can search and replace to keep that from happening, so you don't lose any points on your post for that week. Also, just reminding everyone to abide by the word limits. You've done really well on that. And to make certain you are referencing clearly the places you get your information, which means you don't just say, oh, that was in a lecture on Exodus, and not clear about where in that lecture on Exodus. Or just, Sweeney says this without a page number. So those are a few reminders. Again, the exams, content exams are available. A couple of you have taken them. I think that's a great idea to take a first round, as I said, to get used to it. But I wouldn't use up all my attempts at this point. I'd wait a few more weeks after we've covered a bit more material, which will certainly help you in that content exam. I'm going to walk through questions kind of grouped together about Exodus and Moses, and then maybe even looking at some broader themes. And one of those broader themes, someone asked about, how do we guard against legalism when we are obeying or following God's law? I would say God's Torah. I would point to the Jewish tradition. They never understood these commandments as set in stone, and so legalism would be prevented because you know that these commandments are going to have to keep changing as culture changes, as people change. Also, I think if we can understand that these were commandments that the people freely did, not because they wanted God to love them or forgive them, but as a response to how the holy had worked in their lives. Moving into a bit about Exodus, someone asked the question about why was the Exodus delayed, referencing a text somewhere else, not in Exodus, and that it was 400 years before the people would return, as God said to Abraham. And the response was something in, by the divine is the sin of the Amorites has not been completed. Well, here's the thing. Remember, these stories were not written in sequential order. They were post ex or they were in exile or post-exile probably. And so if you're looking for a reason why you're saying God left you in slavery for 400 years, you're going to come up with the reason why. So it really wasn't about a punishment for sin. It was really just an explanation. And as the post went on to say, it is sort of like the idea that, well, let me back up a bit. Pharaoh and Pharaoh's exchanges with Moses and in the plague stories really wasn't about more punishment for Pharaoh, but really, again, about this idea to challenge the Pharaoh, who was understood as the God of the Egyptians, to show that Israel's God had more power than this human deity of the Egyptian people. There was a question. Let me scroll down here a bit. One person asked about an overall question of the Torah. And the Torah is the first five books. And it was in response to something Sweeney said in his textbook about what do people believe about the Torah? Was it written as a whole, made up of whole cloth, as the post said? Actually, no. The scholarly consensus is that the Torah was compiled in exile and maybe even edited after the return from Babylon, and it definitely utilized oral strands of tradition. But it also may have been woven together with some current understandings of what had happened in exile and afterwards. So I would not say is it's an either or, but a both and, both some oral traditions and some editorial comments of people living in exile or post-exilic Judea. There was a question about Moses' ascent to the mountain to get the commandments, and it says in the text that when God said, "I want you to go do this," Moses took Joshua as his assistant with him. But it's very clear in the Hebrew that only Moses went up on the mountain. It's a singular verb, not a plural verb. So Joshua does not go up the mountain with Moses at that time. A couple other questions. There was a question about in the context of the Israelites' covenant, can you elaborate on how the commandments played a role in shaping the community? Well, as far as we know, no other culture had exactly the same 613 commandments. So it was a unique feature for the Israelite community, post-exilic Jewish community. The commandments were a way that the people could live reflecting the God they worshiped as opposed to other gods. And if you think about how it shaped internal community and outside connections, you will find that within those commandments, there are concerns about worship and how we connect with the holy, and there are commandments about how to treat other people. Love your neighbor as yourself and love the stranger. So this set of commandments that only the people of Israel would follow was shaped and gave shape to an identity that set them apart from all the other nations in that context. There was also a question about references through Genesis and Exodus to people marrying relatives. And the very fact that Exodus 6, verse 20 says that Moses and Aaron's father marries the woman who would have been his aunt. So why would the storytellers keep including these details? Now remember, these stories are not historical accounts. I think that kind of cousin, whatever marriage system was really about the importance of the practice of endogamy, which Israel followed, which meant you married within your tribe. Later, that will be important because your land belongs to the tribe. So they're showing that this is not an external person coming into the story if you're marrying someone who's already in your lineage. Now, we do have stories along the way that are not part of the Israelite lineage that do marry, particularly women who join with an Israelite man. And those outsiders actually add diversity and help to make the story more engaging. Also, remember at the point that we are in Genesis, when Moses, or when Abraham is, marrying his cousin Sarah or whatever she was, there aren't that many people on the earth as far as the people writing the Hebrew Bible are concerned. So you can't say that he went out and married I don't know, somebody who lived in Syria, because you don't know names. These stories are about how Israel came to be. And that was done primarily through marrying within your tribe or your lineage. There was a question about the Exodus and the plague narrative, and I think I went through my interpretations of that. But at the end, the question is, why didn't God just free the Israelites without everything going on in this contest between the Pharaoh and Israel's God? Well, this is a literary device that's meant to show both to Israel and to the Egyptians and those coming after them that Israel's God was more powerful than the God of the Egyptians, who is embodied in the Pharaoh. So it's not that this was some sort of God wanting to put people through suffering. It was an important kind of literary device. Certainly, God could have, or they could have made a story about how God snapped God's fingers and the slaves were free. That didn't typically happen that way. So this is a way to talk about that struggle of power and the people who get caught up in the heat of that struggle with no input, no authority. They're just the objects that get moved around in a game. And I remind us once again that this is how the people who put together the Hebrew Bible, and in particular the story of the plagues, understood God and how God worked in the world. That is not to say that that is how God works in the world, but for that ancient world, they saw God in this contest between human power and divine power. There was a question about why God would not allow Moses to enter the promised land. Well, according to the biblical text, in Numbers 20, verses 6 through 13, God tells Moses to strike a rock to get water, and Moses strikes and nothing happens and hits the rock again. And this is seen as a lack of faith in God, and that is why Moses will not get to enter the promised land. However, I think there's another reason why this story might have been crafted in such a way. If the people who are reading the stories of Moses or hearing the stories of Moses are in Babylon in exile, this reminds them that although they may not see the return to their homeland, the next generation can. So leaving Moses on the edge of the promised land might feel like being on the edge of exile, but maybe you won't make it long enough to see the return. Someone asked if there's any evidence that Joshua was a real person. No, there's not. No evidence that he wasn't a real person, but I think what you get at in your comment is he representative of someone else living centuries later, or perhaps representative of a characteristic that the Israelites want in their ruler whenever the story is taking place? But no historical evidence for anybody in the stories that we are reading right now. Someone asked a bit more about the Shema in Deuteronomy, and I would say the Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, is a proclamation of the fact that Israel worships one God, not multiple gods, but one God. And of course, it goes on to say, you shall love the Lord your God with all you are. That's another faith statement that everything I am is to be offered to God and live in a way that reflects this God I claim for myself. The thing about setting it upon your doorpost or your hand, and whether this would be considered an idol, no, it wouldn't, because you're not saying that the commandments on the doorposts, which today can show up in different ways in Jewish homes, is not something you're going to worship. It's a reminder of how to live, not an object that is supposed to be worshiped like a god, which is really what idols are, things that take the place of the holy in the center of your lives. And therefore, this, the mezuzah, as it's called in later Judaism, that's attached to the doorpost, is simply a mental reminder to everyone as they pass through the door that they shall love the Lord their God with all they are, and they shall follow the commandments as they are appropriate, and that they should treat others the way they want to be treated. I'm looking through. Someone asked a question about the excursus I posted on Exodus 3. I talked about that there is an intrusion note in the first chapters of Exodus and chapter 3 of Exodus, where God now is described as hearing the groaning of the slaves, takes note of them, and wills to deliver them. And I think the question was, why do I see that as an intrusion note? And the answer is because up till that point, we've been following the story of Pharaoh, of Shifra and Puah, of Jochebed, and of the baby Moses. And so when we hear that, we are to think, my goodness, this is really the first time God shows up in the story. We've been going along with the suffering of the people enslaved by Pharaoh. God hasn't shown up until that note in the Exodus text. So I hope that explains what was being asked there. If not, if you ask that question, send me an email. I'll do my best to answer it. I want to make certain I have covered all of your questions here. Someone asked about the number in the book of Numbers that said that that people who were left Egypt and were in the wilderness were 600,000 men plus women and children. Could this have been possible to have had that many, almost a million people wandering around in a wilderness? Well, A, remember, it's a story. Anything's possible. B, the details aren't really what the storyteller's trying to point out. It's still pointing out how strong the people remained. But I think it's an exaggeration on one level, a way of saying a whole bunch of people came out of slavery. Remember, they were reproducing like crazy when they were slaves. So, of course, you'd expect a bunch of people coming out. But for the most part, numbers in the Hebrew Bible, when you see numbers, especially large ones, over 100, are not meant to be literal numbers, but rather are a way of saying a whole bunch or a lot of people. So don't get caught up in the numbers and the math. The story is not about something that could historically happen. The story is about a faith that traces some experience of being liberated from enslavement to a new life and covenant with the holy and with one another. And I think I got everything. So again, if I missed something that you asked in the discussion forum, send me an email and I'll either respond to you in that email or I will wait and add it on for the coming week. So beginning tomorrow, we will move into the next part that talks about how the Israelites made it into the promised land and what happened after that. So I hope that you will continue. Oh, I know what question I missed. So let me finish. I hope you will continue to do good work and make good posts. You've really got to come through strong, so you will do well in your class participation grade. And to wrap things up, someone asked the question about how I had said that the rainbow was God's reminder not to destroy the earth again. And for humanity to see the rainbow and know that that wasn't God trying to kill them. And the question was, is that how I still see rainbows today? No, not really. I see rainbows as the miraculous reflection of light by water droplets in the sky. Still, I think amazing and evidence of a greater a deity in the world who's making the world so beautiful. But no, I don't see rainbows as a promise that God's not going to kill everybody. But it's possible to remind that and remind yourself of that. And maybe that's because I have never been in a place of flooding where I've lost everything and wonder if God was trying to wipe me off the face of the earth. That might be a good place to end. And I hope you have a good week. I'll be back in touch next week. Same time, same channel, we might say. And I wish you all good things. Shalom.